This is Fresh Air. Children have no vote, but they have a powerful advocate in Marion Wright Edelman. Edelman is the founding president of the Children's Defense Fund. For more than 20 years, she's worked for child health, education, child care, and youth employment, as well as teen pregnancy prevention and strengthening family support systems. We talked about the values her parents instilled in her growing up Black in the segregated South, and the values she's tried to pass on to her children. This is also the subject of her new book, The Measure of Our Success, A Letter to My Children and Yours. In the book, she writes, "I worry about the effects of my sometimes difficult, even frantic efforts to balance my responsibility to you, my children, and to other people's children to whom you must share schools, streets, the nation, and the world. Paradoxically, the more I worried about and wanted for you, the more I worried about the parents of children who have so much less." I asked Edelman about the tough choices this has forced her to make.
Well, you know, these are things that every working mother knows. Some of us, though, have an extra set of choices. I mean, I've always been my own boss. But, you know, when you have an important set of meetings and you get up in the morning to head to those meetings and find that one of your children is sick, you know, I stay home. I cancel those meetings and take the risk that somebody will say that I'm unreliable because I don't like leaving my children at home when they're sick. I know that many other parents don't have that choice. And so, you know, while I have found it difficult as a middle-class parent with all of the supports, with a husband, with a live-in housekeeper for the first 12 years of my children's lives, being my own boss, it has still been very difficult for me to juggle. And I've always had enough money because we've been able to figure out what we could do without. We've always had enough books. We've always had enough food. We've always had shelter over our head. And when I think of what it must be like if you were a single parent or a teenage parent or you had handicapped kids or you had no health insurance, I don't know how many parents make it. And so I am enraged that our country does not make sure that parents and children have what they need. And that has to be a priority for our nation.
Now, you mentioned that for the first 12 years of, you know, your life as a mother, that you had a live-in housekeeper. Were you ever kind of embarrassed or ambivalent about that? And I ask that because I think a lot of middle-class people who can afford it but realize how many people can't are very self-conscious about doing it.
No, I'm not ambivalent about that. And Miss Amy is somebody that my mother sent me. She grew up in my hometown, knew me before I was born. And she was not a mother substitute, but she was a very important supplement. And since I've always felt that I had something to contribute, even though my children came first, I was very happy to have that support. I'm not defensive about it. I wish other people had the same choices.
In your book, your A Letter to My Sons, you write, "I hope you will always recognize your dual heritage as the special gift and blessing that it is." Your husband is white. You're African American. Did you always see that dual heritage as a gift and a blessing, or were you worried about it at first, you know, for your children?
Well, my husband is white and Jewish, and the religious differences, I think, were more difficult for us than the racial differences. You don't marry races, you marry individuals. You know, but listen, we're growing up in a world that is increasingly diverse. It is two-thirds non-white. These children come from two peoples, Jews and Blacks, who have withstood the worst that the world can hold. And I happen to think, by my standards, that to have been in recent years enslaved and not slavers is something to be proud of. And so I hope that my children will grow up respecting all kinds of differences, respecting other people, because they have seen that mutual respect in our house. They have seen Christian and Jew be able to coexist. They have seen Black and white coexist and indeed build a community. And that is something that I hope will give them greater strength as we try to teach the world more tolerance.
And you said it was the religious more than the racial differences that you were concerned about. As you mentioned, your husband is Jewish. Your father was a Baptist minister. So how did you handle religion in the house when your sons were growing up?
Well, they went to church with me every Sunday, but they also, when they began to approach adolescence, went to Hebrew school and went through a bar mitzvah in our backyard, what I call a Baptist bar mitzvah, where both sides of the family came together, because the message that we wanted to convey to them is that whether we're Jews or Christians, that we do believe spiritually that there is something outside of ourselves that is more important than ourselves. And I don't know what choices they will make eventually about either or religion, but I do hope that whatever choices they make, that they will be spiritual human beings and know that there is a God there.
As someone who has been a longtime activist in the civil rights movement, I mean, you started in the civil rights movement in the 60s, was it considered a stigma at all to marry a white person?
Well, I didn't marry a white person. I married an individual
that I happened to love.
Right. And so that I don't know what other people considered it. I've never thought it was anybody's business whom I married, just as I never consider it my business whom they marry. And so that I never asked permission. I've never asked people's opinions. And I have not found, whatever, I have not sort of found that it has been an impediment. I don't know what many blacks or many whites think, but I really frankly haven't paid a lot of attention to that.
Did you used to hear your father preach all the time?
Every Sunday.
Uh-huh. What was his style like?
My father was a very quiet man. He was not an emotional man. He was a teacher. And I have lots of his sermons, which I read. A lot of what you will find in my book is a reflection of him. But he taught. But most importantly, he lived what he preached. He was a true servant. He believed deeply in education. He believed deeply in reading. He had a study that I relish even today, which was like a bulletin board into the whole world. I mean, we always had books in our house. We didn't have a lot of clothes, but we always had the complete works of Mark Twain, or we always had great biographies of great men and women like Gandhi or a Reinhold Niebuhr. So my father was just a great teacher, but more importantly, a great example. He believed in service. He believed in finding a way out of nowhere when we could not go sit down at drugstore lunch counters. He built a canteen behind our church for black kids when there were no black homes for the aged. He built one across the street, and all of our family had to help out. When there were kids who didn't have homes, our home was open to them. And so, you know, he just was an extraordinary example and a quiet minister and pastor. My brother has followed in his footsteps as a minister. My nephew, my brother's son, is now a minister. And that ethic of service and achievement and of hard work and a belief that we can change the world is one that is carried on through his kids and his grandkids, and I'm deeply grateful for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marion Wright Edelman. She is the founder and director of the Children's Defense Fund and the author of a new book called A Letter to My Sons. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Marion Wright Edelman is my guest, the founder of the Children's Defense Fund. You were, when you were in college, getting active in the civil rights movement. What was a turning point for you that helped make you an activist or keep you an activist?
Oh, I went abroad my junior year to the University of Geneva, and it was the first time I had ever had a chance to be out of the South and to look back at America, and that was an era when the civil rights movement was just beginning. And once I had tasted freedom as a young black girl who had grown up in a segregated South, I knew that I could never come back into the South and with its restrictions. And happily in 1960, when I returned home to Spelman College in Atlanta, the civil rights movement began. That was when the sit-ins began. And my first plane ride was to Shaw University in Raleigh to form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And Dr. King was there, and we did it under his auspices. So that junior and senior year in college were terribly important.
You ended up going to law school. Did you think that law was what was needed in the civil rights movement? Did you think that that's how you could play your greatest part?
That's why I did choose to go to law school. It never occurred to me that I was going to be a lawyer. I was a music major, and then I was going to go into the Foreign Service. But after the sit-in movement, and I got all caught up in the civil rights movement in 1960, I volunteered at the local NAACP office in Atlanta. And I was stunned at how many complaints had come before that local NAACP office from poor blacks that did not get taken care of because white lawyers at that time, most of them would not take civil rights cases. Most people did not have money. And so I had to ask myself, what am I doing thinking about going off to a Russian institute at Georgetown when what is needed is a lawyer, are lawyers? And so on the spur of the moment, I decided to go to law school. I have no intrinsic interest in the law, but it was the instrument that was needed. And I chose later, after getting out of Yale Law School, to move to Mississippi because there were only 3 black lawyers to serve 900,000 black people in the state at that time, 2 of whom had never gone to law school.
You were the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar.
I was the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar, and the first time I went into federal court into a conference and walked in, you could have heard a pin drop, and none of the men in the room, all white, would shake my hand, but I wasn't clear whether it was because I was black or it was because I was a woman who had stumbled in on this ancient club, but eventually that, too, gave way to change.
Now, how did your work in the civil rights movement lead you to work for children's rights?
Well, it really, one thing was very clear as a civil rights lawyer, that if I worked as I did to desegregate the schools in many counties in Mississippi, but the next day, if the mothers of the children who had desegregated the schools and their fathers were kicked off their plantations and had no jobs and had no place to live and had no food to eat, that my job as a lawyer did not kind of end there. And secondly, it became very clear, even in the first year in Mississippi, that political and civil rights would never have real meaning unless you put the substantive and economic underpinnings under people which would allow them to exercise those rights. And so in the second summer of my sojourn in Mississippi, the Head Start program came after the state of Mississippi refused to take it. Civil rights groups and church groups applied for it and got it. And to watch those poor parents beginning to get involved in educating their children's lives and getting a new sense of possibility and realizing that their children were entitled to health care and to other services, and to see themselves represented in textbooks and to have high expectations by their teachers was a wonderful experience. And so it was out of Head Start and out of recognizing that political and economic and social rights had to go together that led me to form the Children's Defense Fund, you know, eventually.
You've written that working women, working middle class women, have made child care and children's issues a middle class issue. How has that helped you in your work?
It changed the politics because, again, you know, we have not tended to care about the poor or to care about other people as much as we should in our country. And it's only when problems hit us on our front door that we began to care. And because child care, with the majority of mothers having to go into the workforce to stay where we are, has become a middle class issue, that changed the politics. As drugs and violence has begun to permeate a range of neighborhoods, that begins to sort of, you know, get other people who have political clout and who do vote and who do have access to political leaders, that begins to sort of change the politics. As 37 million Americans see what it means not to have health insurance, that begins to change that politics. The people in New Hampshire who didn't care very much about food stamps or about welfare and thought it could never happen to them, but when their factories closed and they found themselves in the food stamp lines, and they are white and New Hampshians, they began to understand these are not other people's problems. And so the problems of children and families, that has got to be what we address in the 90s. And now, because enough whites and enough middle-class folk are affected by that, I think we'll begin to get those changes.
There's something I want you to straighten out for me. I was reading a New Yorker profile of you from a couple of years ago. And Roger Wilkins, the columnist and civil rights activist, said that early on in your days as the head of the Children's Defense Fund, you asked him to take it over. And you said, We need a strong black man. We need the image of a strong black man in a role like this. What happened?
Well, he turned me down, unfortunately. He's a very gifted and talented man who went on to win the Pulitzer as an editorial writer during Watergate for the Washington Post. I grew up with a strong tradition of strong black men. And it saddens me to hear and see so many say that our black males are not pulling their weight or can't make it. I'm the mother of three black sons, and I have known those strong role models, and I know black men who can do everything. I grew up in an era not only of my father, but of Dr. King, of Benjamin Mays. When I was in college, there was Whitney Young and Carl Holman. But I thought at that time, because we were beginning to see more single parents, and because the role of the black man was becoming a little bit more tenuous with less opportunity, that it was important to have a strong male image, and we now have many strong black men working at the Children's Defense Fund. But I was at that time very impressed with Roger's talents and with his image and with his background, and thought that he would be more effective than I would be. And I'm sorry he didn't take the job.
You were willing to hand your job over to somebody else?
I was willing to hand the title over. I still do my work. I think we're here to serve. And one of the things that my father and mother taught me, that you can get an awful lot done in this world if you don't worry about who gets the credit. And we need more servant leaders. We need more people who are willing to do the hard scut work. And social change and big change is not about who's out front. It's about all those people who work quietly every day behind the scenes. I have always been greatly flattered when my words that I struggle with come out into the mouths of people who are well known. If we want to win for children, you're trying to enable and empower other people to carry those messages. And the point is not me. The point is not the Children's Defense Fund. The point is results for children.
I want to get back to your new book, A Letter to My Sons. All parents want their children to have everything that they can and to have everything that the parents didn't have when they were growing up. But you also wanted to make sure, I'm sure, that your sons weren't spoiled by having more, and that your sons had some kind of political and social awareness about the more privileged environment they were growing up in. So how did you balance, as a mother, giving them the things that you wanted them to have and making sure that they had a political, social consciousness about the people who didn't have as much?
Well, that's a hard thing. But again, I think you do that by how you live. And I have worried a lot that my children had too much. I took them to church every Sunday morning and in a black church in Washington, D.C., in the middle of the ghetto, so that they could begin to see what other people live like. We try to create service opportunities, but they should see us doing that service. And so you try to live in a way that your children can see what the world is about and not think that their narrow slice of that world is what other children live with. And so I still worry. But the book, again, is a reminder to them, because I had been so worried that I had tried to protect them against all the things I did not have as a child growing up as a black kid in the South, that I may not have made clear to them all the more important things I did have as a black child growing up in the South. It was the ethic of hard work. It was an understanding that you couldn't take anything for granted. It was, most importantly, an understanding that what life was about. And so one hopes that they will pick up the values by how parents live and by, hopefully, an ethic of service that they have seen all around them.
Marian Wright Edelman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marian Wright Edelman is the president of the Children's Defense Fund. Her new book is The Measure of Our Success, A Letter to My Children and Yours. This is Fresh Air.